Today is Tuesday, September 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United Nations turns 75.
When you look at the United Nations, a lot of people tar it with quite a broad brush. But the fact is that many of its agencies are indispensable.
Plus, what impact will the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy have on the presidential election?
It is an extraordinary year, and the Supreme Court appointment has made this very, very big election bigger still.
And the leaders of Mali's transitional government have been named. We'll have these stories and more next. World leaders came together virtually on Monday to mark the 75th anniversary of the United Nations as the deadly coronavirus pandemic and tensions between the United States and China challenged the effectiveness and solidarity of the 193-member world body. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said it took two world wars, millions of deaths, and the horrors of the Holocaust for world leaders to commit to international cooperation and the rule of law.
Never in modern history have we gone so many years without a military confrontation between the major powers. This is a great achievement of which member states can be proud and which we must all strive to preserve.
Guterres added that it was up to the members to chart a path away from danger. United States Deputy Ambassador Cherith Norman Chalet said that the United States was proud to be the permanent home of the United Nations.
It is hard to grasp the remarkable evolution of the United Nations over the last 75 years, from cautious early steps among a few global leaders to today's vast networks of organizations, agencies, and functions. The UN has grown well beyond the vision of its founders. And yet it is that vision that grounds this institution and must continue to guide its every action.
But Chalet also criticized the body, saying that for too long it had been resistant to meaningful reform.
Too often lacking in transparency and too vulnerable to the agenda of autocratic regimes and dictatorships.
China's President Xi Jinping said on Monday that no country has the right to dominate global affairs, control the destiny of others, or keep advantages in development all to itself. Even less should one be allowed to do whatever it likes and be the hegemon, bully, or boss of the world. Unilateralism is a dead end. Stuart Patrick, senior fellow at the Council on the Foreign Relations, tells the Associated Press that the UN has accomplished a lot during its 75-year history.
Obviously, during a lot of the Cold War, at least when it came to international peace and security, it was largely marginalized from those topics. But nevertheless, it built up a track record, particularly in UN peacekeeping, that is a very cost-effective means of trying to reduce violence around the world. And I would point to UN peacekeeping as one of the hallmarks of what the United Nations has done, not perfectly, but at least that it can be proud of. When you look at the United Nations, a lot of people tar it with quite a broad brush, but the fact is that many of its agencies are indispensable. And humanitarian assistance is one of those areas where the UN on a daily basis provides life-saving assistance to about 80 million people around the world who are either refugees or internally displaced. And so those sorts of things it does very well at. It has a much more mixed record when it comes to human rights promotion, which is another one of its the pillars of its functioning. And you see this in the work of the Human Rights Council.
That was Council on Foreign Relations Senior Fellow Stuart Patrick. The United States has slapped new sanctions on Iran Monday after the Trump administration's unilateral weekend declaration that all United Nations penalties eased under the 2015 nuclear deal had been restored. White House National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said on Monday that U.S. President Donald Trump's administration was imposing new sanctions and export control measures on 27 entities and individuals connected to Iran's nuclear weapons program. The announcement comes in defiance of the international community, which has rejected U.S. legal standing to impose international sanctions. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper outlined the Trump administration's case.
Today's executive order will further disrupt Iranian efforts to import and proliferate conventional weapons, helping protect U.S. forces, our allies and partners, and civilian populations, until Iran complies with international norms. We encourage Tehran to cease its malign activities throughout the region and to act like a normal country. But we are also prepared to respond to Iranian aggression. Our commanders have the authorities and resources they need to protect their troops and to prepare for any contingencies. And we continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with our allies and partners to counter Iran's destabilizing behavior.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo added that Washington was also sanctioning Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro.
For nearly 2 years, corrupt officials in Tehran have worked with the illegitimate regime in Venezuela to flout the U.N. arms embargo. Our actions today are a warning that should be heard worldwide. No matter who you are, if you violate the U.N. arms embargo on Iran, you risk sanctions.
Mohammad Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, spoke with the Council on Foreign Relations. Zarif said it was up to the United States to prove to the rest of the nuclear deal participants, and particularly Iran, that it was going to act responsibly.
I think it is the United States that has to show that it's committed to this deal, that it will not violate it again, that it will not make demands outside the scope of the deal, that it will compensate Iran for the damages. The United States withdrew from JCPOA without any reason. It incurred a lot of damages on the Iranian people.
Zarif also said that he does not rule out retaliation for the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. The Republican majority in the Senate is pushing for a quick vote on the replacement of the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
President Trump wants a vote by Election Day. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he will get it.
We're going to vote on this nomination on this floor.
McConnell brought up why there was no vote in 2016 after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia.
President Obama was asking Senate Republicans for an unusual favor.
McConnell says the president now has the majority party in the Senate. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says it's
an exercise in raw political power.
Schumer says this could have a long-lasting impact.
If a Senate majority over the course of 6 years steals two Supreme Court seats using completely contradictory rationales, How could we expect to trust the other side again?
Ed Donahue, Washington.
Before leaving for events in Ohio on Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump told reporters that Republican senators who oppose voting on a Supreme Court nominee before the election are betraying their constituents.
I would think that would be very bad for them. I think their voters, the people that voted them, put them there because of a certain ideology or a certain feel. And they don't want to have somebody do that. I think it's very bad if they do that.
Justice Ginsburg not only spent time arguing cases before the Supreme Court, while she sat on the bench, she also worked with her colleagues to form opinions. The University of California at Hastings law professor Joel Paul discusses what it means to have a vacancy moving forward.
Well, we already have a court that is highly polarized. Generally speaking, there are five conservative members of the court and four more liberal members of the court. She was considered by many people to be the most liberal or one of the most liberal people or at least the leader of the liberal wing of the court. So losing her means that the liberal members of the court are that much weaker. And I think the most significant part of this is that we are in a moment in time in which there are a great many legal challenges pending in the courts concerning the upcoming election in the United States. There are legal cases that have been brought concerning qualifications to vote, concerning how people can vote, concerning the mail-in ballots and how they will be counted. And all of these cases are likely to get appealed up to the Supreme Court at some point. So there's a fairly good possibility that the Supreme Court may end up deciding the next election, either directly or indirectly. And the possibility that President Trump may appoint a third member of the court may be significant for that reason.
Having, only eight justices on the court now, what would happen if the court was split 4-4 in one of these decisions? Does it go back down to whatever the lower court ruling stands then?
Right. So if you have a situation where no one is confirmed for the Supreme Court before these cases are heard, and the court splits 4-4 on traditional political lines, then the case as decided by the circuit court, the Court of Appeals, would stand. So the circuit court, whatever the circuit court decided in a particular case, would be the law of the land.
That was Joel Paul, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco, California. Now, with so much focus on who will fill the seat on the Supreme Court, has that become the most important topic for the 2020 election moving forward? That's the question I put to Stephen Farnsworth, a political science professor at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
I think that the Supreme Court vacancy creates yet another reason for the people who like Trump to support him and for the people who dislike him to oppose him. I don't know that it really upsets the apple cart in any significant way, but what it does is take those people who've already made up their minds about this election and make them more intense in the direction that they're already leaning towards. One of the things that's really distinct about the 2020 election, we learned from polls, is that very few people in America are on the fence about President Trump. They like him or they don't. And that has not really moved the numbers in good times and bad for the president.
You speak about the people who are on the fence. And like you said, according to poll data, a lot of people have already made up their mind. Could we see those undecided voters now making decision based on what candidate Trump said in the past about wanting to put pro-life justices on the bench that could potentially overturn Roe v. Wade, which is a huge issue for Republican voters?
Yeah, the core Republican base that has supported Trump throughout the impeachment, throughout COVID, throughout all the issues that have come and gone that have been good news and bad for the president, that core group is particularly focused on concerns that are important to evangelical Christians. Those are people who already support the president. I think that one of the impacts that this is going to have is perhaps give those people who were somewhat frustrated and dispirited by bad poll numbers more of a reason to turn out. So I do think this might ramp up the conversation in the direction of greater focus on this topic. But make no mistake about it, the people who are focused on questions of the conservative judiciary already support Trump. In fact, if you were to pick one thing that President Trump has promised to do and has been successful at as president, I think the most clear example of what Trump has done as president is exactly that, putting conservatives into these federal court vacancies where they've occurred. He's done very, very well at getting that done with the Republican Senate helping him along the way.
We're about a week away from the first presidential debate. How do you see the next week for both campaigns tackling this issue of the Supreme Court and, of course, the grim milestone that COVID-19 has taken some 200,000 American lives?
Well, I really think that what you're going to see over the next week, particularly in advance of the debate, is a dueling narrative. The conservative supporters of the president are going to be very, very concerned about this Supreme Court appointment, and the president will likely talk a lot about this vacancy. And the nomination, when it occurs, will get a lot of attention. On the Democratic side, the conversation is talking less about the court and more about the economic and healthcare crisis that is the COVID reality. And that dueling narrative is, I think, going to shape the conversation going forward. I think for the activist community on the left, who would be in favor of abortion remaining legal and accessible, these would be people who would be very focused on the issue without presidential candidates talking about it. I think the same is true for the conservatives on the right. But no doubt about it, if you are President Trump, you want to talk more about the court vacancy than about COVID. American public opinion is unusually divided in 2020. There is huge cleavages in the points of view of the left and the right in this country, and there are very few people who find themselves in the middle. And that creates a very, very difficult environment when it comes to trying to persuade undecided voters. When you look at the unusual year, COVID, the Black Lives Matter movement, the huge spike in unemployment caused by the healthcare crisis, these things are all really, really big things compared to what usually happens in a presidential election year. It is an extraordinary year, and the Supreme Court appointment has made this very, very big election bigger still.
Stephen Farnsworth is a political science professor at the University of Mary Washington. And coming up later,
the draft legislation in Western Australia is called the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill 2020. It would replace outdated 50-year-old legislation and removes a contentious section that allowed the government to give irreversible consent to land users to destroy culturally significant sites.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in 2018, a team of scientists from the Australian National University discovered the fastest-growing supermassive black hole in the known universe. The giant black hole is trying to gobble huge amounts of matter so quickly that it also produces an ultra-luminous quasar. The black hole, simply identified as J2157, is located 12.5 billion light-years from Earth. Since its discovery, the team has conducted further research and has released a new study that provides more detailed information. According to the study's lead author, Christopher Onken, the giant black hole has a mass equivalent to 34 billion times our sun, consumes an amount of matter that's nearly the equal of one sun every day, and is 8,000 times bigger than Sagittarius A, the supermassive black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. New research by the Norwegian Refugee Council finds the economic impact of COVID-19 is pushing refugees and displaced people in conflict into a hunger, homelessness, and education crisis. The report, Downward Spiral, surveyed 1,400 people in 14 countries in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, as well as Afghanistan in Central Asia. And Lisa Schlein has that story.
These countries have been plagued with war, violence, climate change, natural and other disasters for years. Now they are faced with the COVID-19 pandemic, which is creating multiple new problems linked to lockdowns and other restrictions aimed at curbing the virus. The Norwegian Refugee Council reports 77% of people surveyed have lost their jobs or income since March. 70% have cut out one or more meals a day and are going hungry, and 73% say they are unlikely to send their children back to school because of economic hardship. NRC Secretary General Jan Egeland warns the world's most vulnerable communities are in a dangerous downward spiral. He says the economic impact of the pandemic is pushing them to catastrophe.
It is now a question of survival for hundreds of millions, and the North, the big economies, is not even close to understanding the crisis in the South, in the countries where we work.
Egeland says the richer countries are contributing less money at a time when developing countries are most in need of their support. As of now, he notes only 25% of the UN's 2020 humanitarian appeals have been funded. He says cries of poverty by industrialized countries are not credible. To press this point, he refers to a UN report which says the Organization for Economic Cooperation and G20 countries have produced stimulus packages amounting to $11 trillion, approximately 10% of global gross domestic product. He says there is money.
It's just not going to the Sahel where the biggest problem is, to the most conflict-prone countries, to the most disaster-prone countries. This will, of course, lead to instability in some parts of the world that will come back to haunt the robust world.
Egelin says it is in the self-interest of the large economies to help the impoverished world weather this pandemic. He warns this crisis will spiral out of control without urgent action. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New York's Manhattan District Attorney said Monday he could have grounds to investigate President Donald Trump and his businesses for tax fraud. The DA is seeking to persuade a federal appeals court to let him enforce a subpoena for Trump's tax returns. Lawyers for District Attorney Cyrus Vance said the mountainous public allegations of misconduct, including misstatements about business properties, could justify a grand jury probe into possible tax fraud, insurance fraud, and falsifying business records. Jay Sekulow, a lawyer for Trump, declined to comment on the filing. Palestinian security forces have detained several supporters of a rival to President Mahmoud Abbas, who is based in the United Arab Emirates. Mohammed Dahlan, a former senior Palestinian official who was banished from the West Bank in 2010 after a falling out with Abbas, has denied any role in the UAE's agreement to normalize ties with Israel. Palestinians view the agreement as a betrayal of their cause. Dahlan's political movement said Monday that dozens of its members have recently been detained or summoned for questioning by Palestinian security forces in the West Bank. Dahlan has long been seen as a potential successor to the 84-year-old Abbas. The head of Mali's military junta says he will serve as the vice president in a transitional government that's supposed to bring about a return to democracy more than a month after a coup d'etat. But the move is likely to be rejected by the international community, which has called for civilian leadership and the dissolution of the junta. Coup leader Colonel Assame Goïta made the announcement himself Monday on Mali's state television. He said that retired Colonel Major Ba Ndao has been named president of the transitional government, which is set to be inaugurated on September 25th. China sent numerous aircraft close to Taiwan during 2 days of drills from Friday, causing the island's air force to scramble. Reuters' Megan Revelle explains what you need to know.
Chinese U.S. ties are at their lowest point in decades. The most vital and sensitive issue for Beijing, not trade, not Huawei, but Taiwan. In the middle of September, China sent jets close to the island for 2 days of military drills, prompting a scramble of Taiwan's air force. Let's look at why tension is rising around the small island and why it involves Washington. China claims democratically run Taiwan as its own territory, to be taken by force if needed. The island has lived with that threat since 1949. When nationalist forces defeated in the Chinese Civil War fled there. The U.S. has stepped up support for Taiwan lately, sending top officials for 2 visits in as many months.
The United States knows that we will always have a friend in Taiwan.
That plus major new arms sales. To China, the U.S. is effectively backing Taiwanese independence. So why is the island so vital? 2 reasons. Firstly, geography. It lies in a key location on the edge of the Pacific, between the disputed South China Sea and Japan. Secondly, it's a tech powerhouse, home to the world's biggest contract chipmaker, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. The US sees Chinese tech firms as a security risk and has moved to cut off its access to advanced chips, including those from Taiwan. Taiwan and China have no official dialogue mechanism, meaning any small spark could quickly escalate. Taiwan's military is well-trained and well-armed, but dwarfed by China's People's Liberation Army, which is in the throes of an impressive modernization program. Taiwan's president has made upgrading the military a priority, stressing, quote, asymmetric warfare. But China could easily overwhelm Taiwan with missiles, air attacks, cyber attacks, or a naval blockade. China's foreign ministry spokesman.
Taiwan authorities are spending their taxpayers' money on defense, but no matter how much it spends on defense, Taiwan is still a tiny place. Confronting the mainland is like an ant trying to shake a tree.
A conflict over Taiwan may suck in the United States and its Asian allies, though it's an open question whether or not Washington would come to Taipei's aid.
Megan Revelle reports for Reuters News. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has demanded that Russia return the clothes he was wearing on the day he fell into a coma in Siberia. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
In a blog post, Navalny says the nerve agent was found in and on his body, adding the clothes taken off him when he was hospitalized after collapsing on a Russian flight are very important material evidence. He demands they be carefully packed in a plastic bag and returned to him. In a statement, Navalny has blasted Russian authorities for not launching a criminal probe into what happened to him. I'm Charles Deledesma.
Multi-million-dollar fines are part of sweeping new changes to heritage laws to protect ancient Aboriginal sites in Western Australia. It follows the destruction by mining giant Rio Tinto earlier this year of two sacred rock shelters dating back 46,000 years, despite opposition from Indigenous groups. Phil Mercer brings us that story.
The draft legislation in Western Australia is called the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill 2020. It would replace outdated 50-year-old legislation and removes a contentious section that allowed the government to give irreversible consent to land users to destroy culturally significant sites. Traditional Indigenous groups are to be given a greater say in the protection of their land under the proposed measure. In the past, some have agreed to sacrifice sacred sites to help impoverished First Nation communities receive a share in mining revenue. In May, Rio Tinto, the world's biggest iron ore miner, destroyed two ancient rock shelters at Juukan Gorge in Western Australia's Pilbara region as part of a new development. The Aboriginal caves were considered one of Australia's most significant archaeological research areas. Indigenous leaders had strongly opposed development at the site. The outcry, including anger among company shareholders, was so intense that Rio Tinto chief executive Jean-Sébastien Jacques and two senior executives were forced to quit. The new legislation was being drafted before the Juukan Gorge was damaged, and it promises a modern approach to protecting Aboriginal cultural heritage. Western Australian Minister for Aboriginal Affairs Ben Wyatt says resources companies like BHP have already responded positively.
What's already happened as a result of the Juukan caves is that miners with significant locations have effectively ceased work, and you've seen BHP in particular announce that. So those sites of extreme significance are already being reconsidered by the miners or the land users and the traditional owner groups. We've also released our new proposed legislation.
Should the legislation be approved by the Western Australian State Parliament, fines of up to $7.2 million could be imposed for unauthorised damage to Aboriginal sites. But Robin Chappell, a Greens lawmaker, said the bill proposed a new and complex system that under-resourced Indigenous groups would struggle to properly review before an October 9 deadline for public submissions. The Kimberley Land Council, one of Western Australia's biggest Indigenous organisations, said the proposed law completely disregards Aboriginal people and their right to care for their heritage. Tribal elders have demanded more legal protection for Aboriginal traditional owners, including the right to veto developments on their land. Public hearings continue Monday in a federal government inquiry in Canberra into the destruction of the Juukan Gorge caves. It's examining the failures by both government and businesses that allowed the site to be blown up to allow miners to dig out high-grade iron ore. The earth lies at the heart of Australia's ancient Indigenous culture, thought to be some 65,000 years old. Land is considered the mother of creation, connecting Aboriginal peoples to their past, present and future. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.